A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a layered question. He's been watching the protests here in Jerusalem. First the ones during the Gaza War, now the ones about Iran, and he's noticed something that's been bothering him for a while. It feels to him like a lot of these protesters are just anti-government, period, using whatever issue is available as a vehicle. And that got him thinking about the whole concept of opposition in a democracy. If democracy is majority rule, what does it mean to protest the government? Are you protesting the system itself? And then he zooms out further. Why does the formal opposition in a parliamentary system seem to default to criticizing everything the government does, even the things that are clearly good? Is there a version of democracy where opposition doesn't mean blanket oppositionalism, where it's actually constructive? That's the heart of it.
Before we dive into the philosophy, I should mention DeepSeek V4 Pro is writing our script today, so if anything sounds unusually eloquent, that's why.
And I'll take credit for it anyway.
So let's start with the protest question, because Daniel's observation about the Jerusalem protests isn't just a feeling. There's actually a well-documented pattern here. Political scientists call it issue migration, or protest entrepreneurship, where a core group of activists with a pre-existing anti-government agenda attaches itself to whatever grievance is currently salient. You saw this during the judicial reform protests in 2023, then the hostage protests, now the Iran war protests. The crowds overlap significantly.
Right. And Daniel's frustration is that during the hostage crisis, the anger was directed at the Israeli government rather than at Hamas, which, I have to say, I found genuinely bizarre at the time. You have a terrorist organization holding your citizens in tunnels, and the chants are about the Prime Minister.
Here's where it gets interesting, and I want to push back on Daniel's framing just slightly. The fact that some protesters are anti-government opportunists doesn't mean the entire phenomenon is illegitimate. There's a distinction between protesting a government and protesting the system of government. When people in a democracy protest the government, they're not necessarily protesting democracy itself. They're exercising a democratic right to say, this elected government is making decisions we believe are wrong or harmful. That's built into the architecture.
Daniel's point is sharper than that, I think. He's asking, if democracy reflects the will of the majority, and you're in the minority protesting, aren't you effectively saying the majority got it wrong, and therefore the system that empowered them is flawed?
That's the tension, and it goes back to something James Madison wrote in Federalist No. 10 about the problem of factions. Madison's whole project was designing a system where majority rule wouldn't become majority tyranny. The minority doesn't just have to accept defeat and go home. They retain the right to speak, to organize, to protest, to try to persuade enough people to become the next majority. That's not anti-democratic. That is democracy.
There's a difference between persuading and shutting down a city. Daniel mentions protests that block the center of Jerusalem. At what point does exercising your right to protest become a form of coercion against everyone else?
This is the classic heckler's veto problem applied to public space, and different democracies handle this differently. In Germany, for example, you can't just block a major thoroughfare indefinitely. There are permit systems and designated protest zones. In France, blocking roads is practically a national sport. The philosophical question is, does the right to protest include the right to disrupt? And the answer varies by jurisdiction and by political culture.
I think what Daniel's really getting at is the bad faith problem. If you're a protest movement that would oppose the government regardless of what it did, if the same people would be in the streets, whether the issue was judicial reform, a war, or the price of hummus, then your protest isn't really about the issue. It's about power. You lost an election, and you're trying to govern from the street.
That brings us to the concept of the loyal opposition. This is a term that originated in the British parliamentary tradition in the early 19th century. The phrase was first used by John Cam Hobhouse in 1826, and it captures something essential. The opposition is loyal to the state and to the constitutional order, even while opposing the government of the day. They're not trying to overthrow the system. They're trying to become the government within the system.
That loyal part seems to be doing a lot of work, and I'm not sure everyone who protests today has signed on to it.
Right, and this is where Daniel's intuition about the protest being anti-system rather than anti-government might be correct in some cases. There's a spectrum. On one end, you have people who accept the election results but disagree with specific policies. On the other end, you have people who reject the legitimacy of the elected government entirely. They see it as fundamentally illegitimate, and therefore any means of opposing it is justified. That's not loyal opposition. That's something closer to civil resistance against what they perceive as an illegitimate regime.
Which, I should say, is an especially fraught position to take in Israel, where elections are free and fair, turnout is high, and the government has a clear parliamentary majority. If you're calling a democratically elected government illegitimate, you're essentially saying the voters were wrong to elect them. That's a tough sell.
Yet it's increasingly common in many democracies, not just Israel. You see this in the United States too, the rhetoric after the 2024 election, where the losing side described the winning side as an existential threat to democracy itself. When you frame your opponent that way, there's no room for loyal opposition. If the other party is an existential threat, you have a moral obligation to oppose everything they do, using every tool available. Compromise becomes collaboration with evil.
Which brings us to Daniel's second big question. Why does the formal opposition in a parliamentary system seem to default to criticizing everything? Is that baked into the concept?
This is actually a really important question, and the answer is, it depends on how you understand the function of opposition. There are roughly two models. The first is what political scientists call the Westminster model, named after the British Parliament, where the opposition's job is to be the government in waiting. They criticize, they propose alternatives, they hold the government to account, but the ultimate goal is to demonstrate that they'd be a better government. The second model is more adversarial. The opposition's job is simply to oppose, to block, to obstruct, to make the government fail so that voters will throw them out.
Which one do we have in Israel?
That's the thing. Israel's system has elements of both, but it's been trending toward the second model for decades. Part of this is structural. In a multi-party parliamentary system like Israel's, the opposition isn't a single coherent party the way it is in Britain. It's a collection of parties that often disagree with each other more than they disagree with the government on specific issues. The only thing uniting them is that they're not in power. So the default mode becomes opposing everything, because that's the one thing they can agree on.
If you're the head of the opposition, and your coalition includes Arab parties, left-wing secular parties, and maybe some right-wing parties that are out of power, what policy position can you all agree on? Except, the government is bad.
And this creates a perverse incentive. If you're an opposition party, your path back to power depends on the government failing. The worse things go for the country under the current government, the better your electoral prospects. So you have a structural interest in things going badly. That's not to say opposition politicians consciously want terrible things to happen. Most of them care about the country. But the incentive structure pushes toward highlighting failures and downplaying successes.
Daniel's observation about the budget controversy illustrates this perfectly. During a national security crisis, and a war with Iran certainly qualifies, there's typically an expectation of something called rally around the flag effects. Political scientists have documented this. During external threats, opposition parties often moderate their criticism and support the government on national security matters.
The classic example is Britain during World War II. The Labour Party joined Churchill's wartime coalition government. Party politics didn't disappear, but it was subordinated to the national interest. The same thing happened in Israel during the 1967 war, when Menachem Begin's Herut Party joined the government for the first time. There's a tradition of forming a national unity government during existential crises.
Daniel's point is that when the government passed a budget that diverted funding to partisan causes during the Iran war, that felt like a betrayal of the implicit agreement that this wasn't the time for business as usual. The opposition cried foul, and honestly, they had a point.
Here's the flip side, and I want to be fair to the government here. The idea that during a crisis, the opposition should just be quiet and let the government do whatever it wants. That's also dangerous. Crises can be exploited. Governments can use emergencies to push through policies that have nothing to do with the emergency, precisely because they know the opposition will look unpatriotic if they object. It's called disaster capitalism or shock doctrine, using a crisis to ram through a pre-existing agenda.
You've got a genuine dilemma. On the one hand, during a war, you want national unity, and you don't want partisan bickering to undermine the war effort. On the other hand, you don't want to give the government a blank check to do whatever it wants under the cover of emergency. How do you distinguish legitimate opposition from destructive obstructionism?
I think the distinction Daniel is reaching for is between what you might call constructive opposition and blanket opposition. Constructive opposition doesn't mean agreeing with the government. It means opposing specific policies on their merits, offering alternatives, and being willing to acknowledge when the government does something right. Blanket opposition means opposing everything automatically, regardless of merit, because the goal isn't better policy, it's making the government look bad.
Daniel's question is, does constructive opposition actually exist anywhere, or is blanket opposition just the natural state of democratic politics?
It does exist, and there are some interesting examples. The Nordic countries, Sweden, Denmark, Norway, have a tradition of what's called consensus democracy. Opposition parties routinely work with the government on major legislation. Committee work is substantive and cross-party. It's not that they don't disagree, they do, sharply, but the default is an automatic obstruction. There's a norm that the opposition's job is to improve legislation, not just block it.
What makes that work in the Nordics, but not elsewhere?
A few things. One is proportional representation with low thresholds, which means more parties and more coalition governments. When power is shared more broadly, the distinction between government and opposition is blurrier. You might be in opposition today, but in government tomorrow, and you'll need the cooperation of the people you're opposing now. That creates incentives for constructive behavior.
It's essentially repeated game dynamics. If you know you're going to have to work with these people in the future, you don't burn all your bridges today.
Another factor is political culture. The Nordic countries have a strong norm of what the Swedes call sam försten sanda, roughly, a spirit of mutual understanding. It's considered bad form to be purely obstructionist. You can disagree vigorously, but you're expected to engage substantively and offer alternatives.
Compare that to the United States Congress, where the opposition party's strategy for the past couple of decades has increasingly been total obstruction, filibuster everything, refuse to hold hearings on nominees, shut down the government. The idea being that if the government can't accomplish anything, voters will blame the party in power and throw them out.
That strategy has worked, electorally speaking, at least some of the time, which is precisely the problem. If blanket obstruction is rewarded at the ballot box, politicians will do it. The incentives are perverse.
There's an interesting counterexample from Germany. The German Bundestag has a tradition of constructive vote of no confidence. You can't just bring down a government because you don't like it. You have to simultaneously elect a new chancellor. This forces the opposition to actually have an alternative ready, not just tear things down.
Right, that's Article 67 of the German Basic Law. It was designed specifically to prevent the kind of destructive opposition that helped bring down the Weimar Republic, where communists and Nazis would both vote against the government even though they hated each other, just to create chaos. The constructive vote of no confidence says, if you want to remove the government, you have to have a majority for a replacement. It forces the opposition to be constructive.
That's actually brilliant. It changes the opposition's role from make the government fail to prove you can do better.
It's worked remarkably well. Germany has had very stable government since 1949, with only a handful of successful no-confidence votes. The opposition has to be a government in waiting, not just a wrecking crew.
How do we get from here to there? Daniel's frustration, and I share it, is that what we're seeing now, in Israel and in many other democracies, isn't serving citizens. It's a bunch of people arguing about everything, and the actual business of governing, solving problems, improving lives, gets lost in the noise.
I think part of the answer is institutional design. The constructive vote of no confidence is one example. Another is how committees are structured. In the EU Congress, committee chairs have enormous power and the minority party is often shut out entirely. In the British Parliament, Select committees are chaired by opposition MPs as a matter of course, which gives them a stake in the system and forces them to engage substantively.
Institutional design can only do so much. If the political culture is broken, you can't legislate good faith.
No, you can't. And this is where I think Daniel's question touches on something deeper. The adversarial model of democracy assumes that truth emerges from clash, that if both sides argue vigorously, the best ideas will win. That's the metaphor of the courtroom. Prosecution and defense each make their strongest case, and the jury, the voters, decides. It's an attractive idea, but it assumes both sides are arguing in good faith and that voters are paying close enough attention to evaluate the arguments.
Which is a pretty big assumption. If one side is just making things up, or if the media environment is so fragmented that voters live in completely separate information ecosystems, the adversarial model breaks down. It's not a courtroom anymore. It's two different plays being performed for two different audiences.
That's where we are now, I think, in a lot of democracies. The shared factual basis for debate has eroded. When the government and the opposition can't even agree on what happened, let alone what to do about it, constructive opposition becomes almost impossible. If you believe the government is not just wrong, but fundamentally illegitimate or even criminal, then opposing everything they do isn't obstructionism, it's resistance.
Which takes us back to Daniel's point about the protests. If you believe the government is an existential threat to the country, then blocking streets and shutting down the city center isn't anti-democratic. It's a moral obligation. But that's a really high bar. And I'm not sure everyone in those protests has actually thought through the implications of what they're claiming.
There's a concept in political theory called the paradox of tolerance from Karl Popper. Unlimited tolerance leads to the destruction of tolerance by the intolerant. Democracies have to be able to defend themselves against those who would use democratic processes to destroy democracy. But, and this is the crucial point, that doesn't mean every political disagreement is an existential threat. If you treat every election loss as the end of democracy, you're not defending democracy. You're just refusing to accept losing.
That's the thing that bothers me most, honestly. If you can't lose an election without declaring the system broken, you're not a Democrat. You're a partisan who's willing to use democratic rhetoric when you win and anti-democratic tactics when you lose.
That's not a left-right thing. You see it across the spectrum. When the left loses, they say the system is rigged by oligarchs and dark money. When the right loses, they say the system is rigged by deep state bureaucrats and media bias. The specific accusation changes, but the underlying refusal to accept defeat is the same.
What's the alternative, Daniel asked, if there are forms of democracy where opposition isn't just blanket oppositionalism? We talked about the Nordics and Germany. Are there other models?
Switzerland is a fascinating case. They have a system called the magic formula, where the major parties share executive power proportionally. The Federal Council has 7 members from multiple parties, and they govern by consensus. There's no real government versus opposition dynamic at the executive level. Major decisions are often made through referendums, which means the opposition is really just the losing side in a popular vote, and they accept the result and move on.
I'm not sure that scales to larger, more diverse countries, but I see the appeal. If everyone's in government together, there's no incentive to sabotage things just to make the other side look bad.
Right, but it has its own problems. Consensus systems can be slow, they can lack accountability. If everyone's responsible, no one's responsible, and they can stifle innovation. Sometimes you need a clear opposition to challenge entrenched thinking and push for change.
That's a fair point. So maybe the goal isn't to eliminate adversarial politics entirely, but to channel it constructively. To have opposition that's vigorous and principled, but also loyal and substantive. Opposition that says, here's what we'd do differently, rather than just everything they do is terrible.
Which brings me to something I think Daniel would appreciate. There's a distinction in political theory between opposition and resistance. Opposition works within the constitutional framework to change policy and eventually take power. Resistance works outside or against the constitutional framework to challenge the legitimacy of the system itself. Both have their place. Resistance against authoritarian regimes is noble and necessary. But in a functioning democracy, opposition should be the default, and resistance should be reserved for truly exceptional circumstances.
The problem Daniel's identifying is that too many people are jumping straight to resistance mode, when what's actually called for is opposition mode. They're treating a government they disagree with as if it's an authoritarian regime, which both devalues the concept of authoritarianism and undermines democratic norms.
There's a great line from the political scientist Juan Linz, who studied democratic breakdowns. He said that democracies don't usually fall because of a sudden coup anymore. They die by a thousand small cuts, often inflicted by elected leaders who claim to be acting in the name of the people against a corrupt elite. But the erosion also comes from oppositions that refuse to play by democratic rules, that treat every issue as existential, that delegitimize institutions when they don't get their way.
Both sides can contribute to democratic erosion. The government can overreach, and the opposition can delegitimize.
And that's why the concept of loyal opposition is so important. It's not about being nice or avoiding conflict. It's about maintaining a shared commitment to the democratic process even when you're losing. It's about saying, I think the government is wrong about this policy, and I'm going to fight them on it, but I accept their right to govern until the next election, and I accept that if I lose that election too, the voters have spoken.
I want to circle back to something Daniel said about opposition parties criticizing everything. He found it strange and unconstructive, and I think he's right that it's unconstructive, but I also think there's a reason it happens that goes beyond bad faith. If you're an opposition party, your job is to hold the government to account. That means scrutinizing everything they do. And in practice, that often looks like criticizing everything, because no government is perfect, and the opposition's role is to highlight imperfections.
Right, and there's a legitimate function there. The government should have to defend its decisions. The opposition should be asking hard questions. The problem is when the criticism becomes performative rather than substantive, when the goal is to generate a headline or a viral clip rather than to improve policy.
The media environment rewards performative criticism. If you give a nuanced speech about how the government's policy has some merits but needs adjustment in three specific areas, nobody covers it. If you call the prime minister a traitor, you lead the evening news.
That's the attention economy at work. Outrage drives engagement. Engagement drives revenue, so the whole system is tilted toward making politics more adversarial and more extreme.
What do we do about it? Daniel's asking if there's a better way, and I think we've identified some institutional reforms that could help. Constructive votes of no confidence, opposition-chaired committees, proportional representation that encourages coalition building. But a lot of this comes down to norms and culture, and those are harder to change.
I think one thing that would help is if more people understood what the loyal opposition is supposed to look like. It's not supposed to be a cheering section for the government. It's not supposed to be quiet during crises. It's supposed to be a credible alternative, a team that's ready to govern, that has a platform and a plan, that engages with the government's ideas on their merits, that says, here's what we'd do differently, rather than just, here's why they're terrible.
That requires opposition parties to actually do the work of developing policy alternatives, which is harder and less glamorous than just attacking the government.
It requires expertise, discipline, and patience. It requires thinking beyond the next news cycle. And it requires a certain humility, an acknowledgement that governing is hard, that trade-offs are real, and that the other side might occasionally have a point.
I think that's what Daniel's really getting at. He's not saying the opposition should just agree with the government. He's saying the opposition should be FOR something, not just against everything. They should be advancing an alternative agenda, not just tearing down the current one.
That's actually the original vision of parliamentary democracy. Edmund Burke, the 18th century British statesman, described a political party as a body of men united for promoting by their joint endeavors the national interest upon some particular principle in which they are all agreed. Note that, promoting the national interest upon a principle, not just opposing the other side, having a positive vision.
Compare that to what we see now, where parties are often defined more by what they're against than what they're for. The coalition is held together by shared enemies, not shared principles.
That's a fragile basis for politics, because once you defeat the enemy, what holds you together? We've seen this happen repeatedly in Israeli politics. Broad coalitions that form to oust a particular leader and then can't agree on anything else.
If Daniel's looking for hope, where does he find it?
I think there are some encouraging signs, even if they're modest. In the EU, the Labour Party under Keir Starmer made a deliberate effort to move from blanket opposition to constructive opposition, to present themselves as a credible government, in waiting rather than just a protest movement. In Germany, the Christian Democrats have done similar work. It's not flashy, but it's how democratic politics is supposed to function.
On the protest side, I think there's a distinction worth making between protesting specific policies and protesting the legitimacy of the government itself. The first is healthy, the second is corrosive, and citizens need to be more discerning about which kind of protest they're participating in.
I'd add that governments also have a responsibility here. If you want a constructive opposition, you have to create space for it. You have to engage with criticism substantively rather than dismissing all critics as enemies of the state. You have to be willing to lose arguments, to compromise, to admit mistakes. A government that treats all opposition as illegitimate is just as corrosive to democracy as an opposition that treats all government as illegitimate.
That's a really important point. The dynamic goes both ways. If the government labels everyone who disagrees with them a traitor or a foreign agent, they're making constructive opposition impossible. They're forcing the opposition into resistance mode because they've closed off all other avenues.
We've seen versions of this in multiple democracies recently. Leaders who describe the press as the enemy of the people, who call opposition parties disloyal, who suggest that elections they didn't win were fraudulent. That rhetoric doesn't just reflect polarization, it actively creates it. It tells voters that the other side isn't just wrong, they're illegitimate. And once that idea takes hold, constructive opposition becomes impossible.
What Daniel's observing in Jerusalem isn't just an Israeli problem, it's a democratic problem. The erosion of the loyal opposition, the blurring of the line between opposition and resistance, the weaponization of protest, the degradation of political discourse into blanket criticism, these are happening across the democratic world.
The solution, to the extent there is one, involves rebuilding the norms and institutions that support constructive opposition. That means electoral reforms that reward coalition building rather than polarization. It means media reforms that reduce the incentive for outrage-driven coverage. It means civic education that teaches people what loyal opposition looks like and why it matters. And it means political leaders on both sides who are willing to model constructive disagreement rather than total warfare.
None of which is easy or quick. But I think Daniel's question is a good one because it forces us to ask, what is opposition actually for? If the answer is just to oppose, that's not enough. Opposition has to be in service of something. Better policy, better government, better outcomes for citizens. And if it's not doing that, it's failing, no matter how many headlines it generates.
There's a quote I like from the British politician Rab Butler, who spent a lot of his career in opposition. He said that the job of the opposition is to be the alternative government, not the alternative to government. That distinction between being a government in waiting and being an anti-government movement is exactly what Daniel is getting at.
I think if more opposition politicians took that seriously, a lot of Daniel's frustrations would dissolve. You can disagree vigorously without being disagreeable. You can hold the government to account without hoping the country fails. You can be a patriot and an opponent at the same time.
Which, by the way, is exactly what the loyal in loyal opposition means. Loyal to the country, loyal to the Constitution, loyal to the democratic process, even while opposing the current government with everything you've got.
I think that's a good place to land. Daniel, you asked whether opposition in a democracy has always had this assumption of just being oppositional, and whether there are forms of democracy where opposition is more constructive. The answer is, the loyal opposition was supposed to be constructive all along. That was the original idea. It's not a bug in democracy that needs fixing. It's a feature that's been eroded and needs restoring. And yes, there are models, the Nordics, Germany, Switzerland, that show it's possible to have vigorous opposition without blanket obstructionism. It's hard. It requires the right institutions and the right culture, but it's not impossible.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The pistol shrimp snaps its claw so fast that it creates a bubble that collapses with a temperature of over 4,700 degrees Celsius, nearly as hot as the surface of the sun, and produces a sound louder than a gunshot.
I'm sorry, a shrimp does what now?
4,700 degrees. In a bubble. I have no follow-up.
Neither do I.
This has been My Weird Prompts, produced by the indefatigable Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, head over to myweirdprompts.com for more.
We'll be back soon with another one. Until then, try not to snap your claws too hard.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.